Well, we're in Mark chapter 14. Are we set? We're in Mark chapter 14. All right. We're picking it up in the middle of the chapter, a little bit down the way after Jesus speaks about Mary from Bethany, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, that her pouring of her precious oil upon him, her perfume, was not a bad thing, but a good thing. Judas being the instigator of the thought that the money should have been sold and money given to the poor. His true colors come out. Verse 10, then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. So he sought how he might conveniently betray him. Judas's plan for betraying Jesus wasn't a sudden thing. He planned this out before the Passover. This is before they get to the table, you'll see, and we'll comment further on him in a minute. Verse 12. Now the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, where do you want us to go and prepare that we may eat the Passover? And he sent out two of his disciples and said to them, go into the city, and a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him. Wherever he goes in, say to the master of the house, the teacher says, where's the guest room that I may eat the Passover with my disciples? Then he will show you a large upper room, furnished and prepared, and there make ready for us. So his disciples went out and came into the city, and please take note of this sentence, and found it just as he had said to them. And they prepared the Passover there. I love that. The disciples, two disciples are sent. You kind of wonder if this is the same two disciples that he sent to go get the donkey that was somebody else's donkey because they've really learned a lesson already, or if he maybe picked another two just to blow their minds. But we won't get into how Jesus knew and what he used to know this issue that would be happening with the man with the pitcher on his head. We just know Jesus knew. And I have tried this very thing. I went to Longfellow's and said, where's the upper room that I should have a meal? And they kicked me out. So be careful how you take scripture and say, I can just do this. But on the other hand, you can do, and you can learn to expect the things are just as Jesus said they'd be. See, you can expect Jesus to do what he said. You might not understand everything he's doing. Your timing might be different than God's, but faith in action is faith in his promised word, not just a generic faith, I believe in God. Believing in God just generically doesn't really bring you any growth in faith. When you believe a specific promise that God has made, now you're not just believing in God, but you are believing God. See, I believe in God, I believe in God. What does that mean? All kinds of people believe in God in whatever way they want. Do you believe God? Do I believe God? And my faith grows in accordance with when I take a step of faith based on a promise God's made. And here we find that things are just as he said. I won't really learn that till I walk through the journey step by step with him. Now, continuing on 17 through 26, and then we're going to go in a specific direction. We see that Jesus really never lied to his disciples. So his disciples found it as he'd said, as we found it. And in the evening, in verse 17, he came with the 12. Now as they sat and ate, this is the Passover meal, Jesus said, assuredly I say unto you, one of you who eats with me will betray me. This is if you want to kind of bring a dinner party down, this would be the way to do it. Let's get all your friends together, all your closest friends, and say, one of you is going to turn on me and seek to destroy me. See how your dinner party goes. And they began to be sorrowful and said to him one by one, is it I? And another said, is it I? Which is good. Instead of saying, is it him? Is it him? Which they might have done earlier. He answered and said to them, it is one of the 12 who dips with me in the dish. The Son of Man indeed goes just as is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had never been born. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to them and said, this, take, eat, this is my body. Then he took the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. And he said to them, this is my blood in the new covenant, which is shed for many. Assuredly, I say to you, I will no longer drink of the fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God. And when he had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. The bitter herbs that are commanded to be eaten at Passover represent the bitterness of slavery. They would dip their bread, flat bread, and in this case, unleavened bread, or other types of herbs, into the bitter herbs, which we use horseradish when we have our Passover because it's a bitter herb, and not because it goes great with the roast beef or prime rib. We use it because you try to get it really strong, because the point is that you're to taste the bitterness. And what was the bitterness of the slavery that Israel had experienced in Egypt? Now, there's this entire process that goes on that we're not going to cover today, even though it's somewhat in this chapter, the Passover meal. Because what I want to bring to you in this is we see Jesus, first of all, dip into the bitterness of betrayal willingly. And Judas dips with him. And the number one thing I said I'd mention something about Judas, almost forgot. People have all kinds of opinions. They can write books this thick about Judas's real motives, and he's a sincere guy that just got off track, and you can make all your movies you want and take all these offshoots and do everything you want to do, people do. According to Jesus, he's a thief, according to the scriptures, and he's more than a thief here. He's a betrayer. He's not a confused young man. And Jesus' statement is it would be better for him to have not been born. That's because of where he's headed. I have nothing to add to it. I'm not going to clarify it. I'm not going to soften it. I'm not going to change it. The best person to understand, who is a little closer to the situation than authors and writers and people with opinions, is Jesus. And he said it would be better for that man to never have been born. He's a betrayer. So I'm just going to leave it there. Okay. Now, many of you have seen the movie The Passion of the Christ. For some, it was way too violent for you. For others, it was very eye-opening. Most of us have been around the church enough to hear or just heard the term Passion Week. The Passion of Christ, aside from that movie, the term The Passion of Christ, Christ's Passion, or Passion Week, which means this week in which Jesus comes into Jerusalem, celebrates the Passover, is then taken, and he is mocked and beaten and spit on and stripped naked and just crucified, and he rose the third day. The Passion of our Christ. You see, he willingly, passion, just what does that mean? Well, people will give it a little different angle, but it obviously means that his deep desire. Let me do it this way. What he also said at the Passover is on the front of your bulletin, and we'll just read it. You don't have to look, but it's there for you. Then he said to them, this is as he's sitting at the same table. It's just in Luke, you know, more information. Then he said to them, with fervent desire, I've desired to eat this Passover meal with you before I suffer. For I say to you, I no longer will eat of it until it's fulfilled in the kingdom of God. Same thing, basically, but he says those words. Those words are with fervent desire. In the Hebrew, the word for desire or fervent, and it's doubled up. It's the same word kind of said twice. With desire, I've desired. And so it's good translation, with fervent desire. It's doubling up, it's intensifying the meaning. I have extremely, you can start using your own, you know, words. I've extremely passionately desired. Would you say that this shows a good deal of passion in Jesus? He didn't say, sure, I could go to this dinner. What time is it at? What time is that dinner again? He didn't say, I guess I'll eat Passover with you. Now, if Jesus is intense about this, with passion, with extreme desire, I've desired to eat this meal with you, that would probably cause someone who is sincerely seeking after him to perk up. Kind of turn your ear in. Get how close can I get to this? How much can I learn to understand this? You know, you can yawn. I've already heard this. But I would say the reason that we celebrate communion often, the reason that we follow the Passover, the reason that we read his words is because they're real. And he is intensely passionate. So the passion of the Christ, his willingness to go through all this for us, his deep, deep pain and suffering was to bring an end that would bring us to glory with him. You could word it a whole bunch of different ways. The passion of Christ, what he went through and what he saw ahead of him and what he saw he would fulfill. The Passover was no ceremony to Jesus. I have a burning desire to share this with you. So what we want to do, Passover, all the things we're reading here, we could itemize each thing, but we've done that a bunch of times. So for today, when you think of Passover, you naturally would go back to the first Passover. Turn to Exodus chapter 3, if you would. Genesis, Exodus. And chapter 3. And it's a story that it's not as famous as the parting of the Red Sea, but it's close. And particularly to believers, Jews, and Christians. So we're going to read a part of it. And as you're turning there to Exodus chapter 3, we are taking a journey back to appreciate Jesus' passion for his disciples to eat that dinner, which extends with his passion that exists today, which goes back and beyond the first Passover. God's passion to deliver his people. Exodus chapter 3. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, it declares Horeb the mountain of God in retrospect. Moses didn't know that it was the mountain of God. That's later because of the promises and coming back there. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he was looking, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, guess I'll go look at it. I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. Now, I always wanted, sadly, I end up wanting to do that woman off of the original, Moses, Moses. But I think God's voice, not ladies, he could have any voice he wants, but it probably was, Moses, I'd be on radio if I had the voice that could do this, but Moses, Moses, Moshe, Moshe, here I am. He said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them from the land to a good and large land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, Hivites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I've also seen the oppression on which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Stop there. We're not going to talk about Moses' reply, but we are going to talk about what's happening here. 400 years in Egypt. Slaves. This means that a generation would be born. And as they grew up, they would say, oh, God, send us our deliverer that was promised to us, that Abraham declared. And they would live entire lives and bear children and then have grandchildren should they live so long. And then they would die. And then their children would grow old. God, send us our deliverer. And then they would die. Are you with me? Nobody can explain this perfectly. Nobody can understand humanly how God didn't suddenly hear after 400 years. He declared to Abraham they'd be there 400 years. They're not the only slaves. They're not the only people oppressed. They're not the only people that lived lives that were difficult. But they did all of that. And the ones who trusted in God have nothing to be ashamed of. That they trusted in that promise. Just as a Christian through history that's been persecuted or had hard life and you know, I did a funeral for a guy, and you read his story, it's kind of like reading the story of the dog Lucky, you know, one leg and one eye, and he answers to Lucky. It's just a joke story about a dog that you know, they're looking for the dog. I should have just told the story, but I'm not trying to make a joke. I'm not trying to make a joke about it. I'm saying this guy's life read like this, all the things that happened to him. He's a Christian guy, and I didn't know him. And I got this crowd of 200 people that I don't know except a few of our church. We're hosting it at our church through somebody that is a relative of his, but mostly I don't know these people. And I'm talking about him, and I said, you know, these things happen. I said, you know, whatever his name was, Henry's life really didn't go like he planned. Has any of your lives gone like you planned? And 200 people, I'm saying, did one or two not shake their heads? Probably, but I'm talking, and I was just being somewhat rhetorical. I wasn't asking them to really respond. Has any of your lives gone the way you planned it would? And to a person, it was like they all went like this. Oh. And I use that in funerals because I know that it exudes a response and I can help people see something there. But at that time, I said that just ad hoc, and I was like, I almost went back in my seat. I went, yeah, well, yeah, where am I? That's the point. You know, they overwhelmed me because they were honest in that moment all the way across the room. Life has not gone the way we planned. But God had a plan. And he says, I've heard and I've seen and I'm coming to deliver them. And that's the story of Christians through history, even those who've died waiting for Jesus to come. And if there wasn't those stories in the past and in history and in the community of God's people, if there wasn't major blow up, big time, huge stories like this, you'd have more struggles with God than you have right now. Because you'd think I'm the only one. I don't get it. When I read the Bible, I see people just, they got the Midas touch. They just get blessed everywhere they go and nothing goes wrong. Could you show me that Bible? I see stories like this in the Bible. Don't you? It's honest truth about hard life on planet Earth because of a fallen race and troubles. And God will bring glory to himself through those struggles. And there's ahead of us, there's a victory over all of it. And if it wasn't like that, God never lied to us in the Old Testament either. He tells us the truth. And yet he also tells us the truth that you have trouble and I have trouble sometimes grasping. I've heard, I've seen, I'm coming, and I'm not late. You know, that's... So God has passion towards his people. It hasn't waned, it hasn't faded. How passionate is God? Some people say the burning bush is a picture of grace and mercy because it's thorn bushes, which is true. The original language of the bush sounds like a thorn bush. And God burns off the sin but keeps us so we don't get consumed. And it's beautiful. To me, what I read this last week, because we were in Proverbs 5 on Tuesday and I was thinking about passion, and then I was thinking about Passion Week, and then all of a sudden my mind raced to the burning bush. Because if you want a picture of passion from God's view, from God's character, I think here it is. It's in Jesus, but it's also right here. It's a picture of God's nature and his passion. The flame is eternal. It keeps going. How long could a bush that doesn't disintegrate burn? How long does a fire burn if it's got fuel? It just keeps going. So, I mean, it's eternal flame, of course, but it's God's nature that's eternal, and it's God's nature that is passionate. Our God is a consuming fire. I have seen and I have come to deliver my people from their bondage. But Moses, take your sandals off. This is holy ground. taking your sandals off doesn't just exude, you need to bow and be humble, though that's certainly embedded. But Moses, in order for you to experience intimacy with me and draw close to me, you must have purity. You can't make yourself pure. That's not what we're talking about. But your shoes, your sandals, come between you and my holy place. That's your world where you walk. Take them off. I don't want anything coming between me and you and where I am. That's mine and others' interpretation. You can look at it how you want. It is, yes, humble yourself. It is take reverence for what I'm doing. The fact that we have a casual atmosphere does not mean we have a casual attitude about God. I believe in having casual atmosphere. I wouldn't say so much of a belief. I think churches get to do and Christians get to be however God's made them to be. There are groups. There are people that could never come in this building. Look at this stuff. I mean, they'd go nuts. They'd say, "What are you? Are you crazy? You know what I mean? This would be a bad news for them." And I don't blame them. Those aren't the people we're going to probably reach. We're not built that way. There are people, if it was all stained glass and very ornate and very proper, they just couldn't get in the door. I don't have an issue with either way or any in between. The point is, do you worship Jesus? And purity and reverence has to do with the attitude of your heart. It's the way it comes out of your mouth, too. May I suggest that there's never a time that God wants you and me to speak impurely or to think impurely. And what somebody else does, if that gives you a reason to be impure, you're misguided. You're using other people as an excuse for your own behavior to be off. I believe in purity very strongly. I don't mind people calling me on it if I get off on it. There's a difference between casual atmosphere, relaxed atmosphere, and casual about the holiness of God. Make sure you understand that, not for my benefit, for your own, because I think I kind of understand that. Purity is a real important thing. It is not, you won't hear it talk, you won't turn the radio on or watch TV or go by the water cooler and say, "I'm really looking at how I can walk purely with God, how my life and my thoughts can be pure." You're not going to find that. But you are going to find people who long for something more and feel ripped off in life. And they don't know they lack purity. They don't know they lack purity. And you might be able to help them, not judge them, condemn them, or yell at them, but help them. You see, without purity, there's no intimacy with God. Take your sandals off your feet. I've beckoned you, I've called you to be close to my heart in my presence, but my passion is holy, my passion is pure, and without purity, you can't experience who I am. And God does not wane, God has not diminished in his love and his passion to deliver. He provides for Moses to be able to come near to him. You know, to come to himself. The bush is still burning, brothers and sisters. The bush is still burning. It was burning 400 years after Israel went into bondage, and it was burning when Jesus said with fervent desire, "I have desired to eat this Passover meal with you." And that life of Christ, that love of Christ, that passion of Christ, God's eternal flame of love for you is still burning this very moment. The Father's passion then was wrapped up in Jesus. And on the back of your bulletin, don't turn there now, I have some scriptures listed for you that kind of debunk the concept. It asks the question, is the God of the Old Testament one God that's the mean God, and then Jesus is the good God that calms his Father down, kind of? And inside from all those verses, I got six words Jesus said that kind of debunk all that really clearly. You don't have to understand how the Old Testament worked to get this. Just say, the God of the Old Testament, Jesus said, "I and my Father are one." That verse alone, that sentence alone out of the mouth of Jesus kind of settles it for me. I'm not saying I understand everything. I'm saying I and my Father are one. Just because you don't understand something, don't build a doctrine. And you don't have to be a Christian theologian to build a doctrine. It's how you think in your mind. is a doctrine. How you determine how you look at God is a, here's how he is. And I'm saying this not just for your benefit, for the people you talk to. Don't build a doctrine, an understanding, a teaching based on what you don't understand. That's not how you don't build an airplane. Well, I don't really know how to do an airplane, so I'll do it the way I don't know and try to fly it. Okay? You don't do that. But people do that with God. They base everything on what they don't understand. And so I don't blame non-believers. I think Christians have a role to play to help non-believers. So the fathers, the angry father of the Old Testament, no, man, I've seen my people and I love them. And yes, did God ever get mad? Of course. Did Jesus ever get mad? Of course. But he is pure and he is holy. And passion is wonderful and passion is dangerous. You won't find a more passionate guy in the Old Testament than David. His music, his psalms, his crying out to God, his whole desire for God, his leadership and fighting Goliath. And then you also find his passionate one awry, and he committed, if you will, a crime of passion. Joseph's brothers had a crime of passion. You know what we call a crime of passion? You don't sit down and go, okay, I need money. That bank over there, they're a little lax. I've studied it. You know, I got my computer out and I, you know, did cameras and I know how to shut off their system and I'm going to go in and steal $1 million. That's not a crime of passion. That's just a thief, a good thief, perhaps, good at being a thief. Crimes of passion are, it rises up out of you in relationships and et cetera, and you just act out. It's kind of like, you know, passion is just this thing where you put a pot on the stove. Gail has allowed me this a few times. I can see why she said, oh, I'll do it. That's okay, Rick, I'll do it. I mean, you know how people say I can't boil water? I can boil water. But when I, for some reason, when I boil hard-boiled eggs, you know, invariably, one of you calls me and I get talking in the other room and then, Rick, I got it. Do you know what I mean? When you boil something on the stove, you bring it to a boil and then you put it on simmer and you let it boil, but you don't let it boil over. Then it's out of control and destroys everything. See, passion is wonderful and passion is dangerous. And you know, when you think of the word passion in our culture, the natural first thought, and if this is just me, then maybe you just need to pray for me that I have a purer mind. But when I think of the word passion, my immediate thought goes sexual passion. Now, if I happen to be walking by a pizza, now it's different. But generally speaking, that's what you think of with, and especially when you think of crimes of passion and being out of control in passion. But it's not that, it's anything. Any desire that takes, with fervent desire I've desired, is a good thing. Having passion is a good thing. Some of you teenagers, and you're all really good at this, but I remember when everybody just had a phone in their house. This is a hard concept for some of you, but there was actually a landline phone, and that's all anybody had. And you call the house, and you get the teenager, usually a boy. Oh, hi, is your mom or dad there?
I don't know.
Well, could you check and see? Oh, yeah, that's right. She's at the store. Okay, well, can I leave her a message?
Okay.
Are you there?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, this is Rick Cohen. Do you have a pencil?
No. Let me go look.
You,
I can't find a pencil.
So, well, when you regain the will to live, I'll call back. Now, on the other side of this, now here's the other side. That young man, poor guy, I've had that guy many times. That young man, when his friends call, I don't think he's so dispassionate as when it's Rick Cohen. I mean, who cares? And he doesn't need a pencil when his friend calls because they never do anything organized. And I don't blame him. I'm not mad at him, and I forgive me if I'm putting him down, but it's like, have you lost the will to live, you know, the way you answer that phone? But you know, if you see people that have no passion about anything, if you have been through a time where, well, let me say this, Moses seems to have lost his passion. hasn't he? I mean, I don't know what the backside of that desert is, because I don't think the front side's all that great, okay? But he's in the backside of the desert alone. It's 40 years now, and he's still watching somebody else's sheep. It's his father-in-law's. That doesn't sound like a passionate life to me. Does it sound that way to you? Plus, Moses is a guy who had passion, and he jumped in it and said, I got to kill this Egyptian that's beaten my brethren, and that didn't work out because his passion, he's kind of had that pot overflowing, and he bubbled over, and maybe God used it and had a plan, and I don't know how to put all that together. I'll let God put all that together, but he had to run, and now he's 40 years out, and he has no interest. Folks, he has no interest. He has no passion, at least seemingly. He has no passion to go deliver those people, to be a part of the plan. Where did his passion come from when it came back? It came from God, not from Moses. Not from his good character or his specific nature or his personality or because he was so gifted and tooled that way. And when he argues with God, he argues about all the things you would think a guy would have if he was going to go do this. This is not about Moses. It isn't about Moses' ability. And Moses is called a great man for a lot of good reasons because God instilled passion in him. So much so that when God said, step aside, and it was a test, and it was God drawing Moses out like his name means, step aside, I'll destroy this people that are so disobedient, that Moses pleads with God, no, for your own namesake, you must protect these people. You got to keep them. But that was God working in Moses. It wasn't Moses. So you sit here today, you say, well, you know, Rick, you seem very passionate about God. I'm just not like you. First of all, you don't have to be just like me. Thank God you're not just like me. But folks, don't hide under that. Don't hide under that. Don't hide. That has nothing to do with it. How my personality is or how I exhibit what is true passion from God, because it comes from God and it's meant for everybody. And you'll exhibit it differently than other people, and that is totally okay. And there isn't a person in this room that wants a passionless life. Everybody in this room and in every other room today, you were made for passion. And you exhibit it. It might be for your motorcycle or for your girlfriend or for your guitar or for food or for whatever it is or for sex. And you can destroy yourself with it or you can let the pot simmer nicely. And we all got some learning to do. So passion brings down leaders and nations. Rome was brought down by their sexual passion for one part of it, if you read their history. And it destroys families. But God intended it for good. Just as Joseph's brothers tried to kill him, but they ended up selling him as a slave. But he says to them later when dad dies, don't worry, I'm not going to revenge you. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. But secrets, lies, pornography, illicit relationships all tear away. In a marriage relationship, in a man and a woman, in the proper healthy relationship, and none of them are perfect, but these kinds of things will absolutely tear away. Purity tears away intimacy. You can't have intimacy where there's lies. Not the intimacy God intends. You can't have intimacy of any kind. Listen, I don't mean to be crude. I don't think this, it's just, and people are saying a lot worse things for a lot worse reasons than I'm going to sit here today and talk about for a minute. But two dogs can easily have sex on your front yard, and they don't have intimacy, and they don't care. And people who say we're just sophisticated animals, well, if we're so sophisticated of animals, why can't we get over? Because even the movies that suggest it's okay to do it all everywhere and all this stuff, actually most of the movies that talk about, always look to bring people to a point where you find a true love and where there's just one and one, and there's this, in their minds, you can have all this purity with all the other garbage with it. And God knows we all need forgiveness and healing and renewing anyway. But why is there such a desire in people? People try to fight it, but people want intimacy. They want strength of relationship. They want purity in a relationship. I've never had anybody say, hey, I say, give me a cup of water. I bring him a cup of pure, you know, bottled water. I say, hey, listen, pour a little dirt in there. I like my water more impure. I've never heard anyone say, I need to find somebody who will lie to me. I like getting lied to. Now, it's okay for me to lie. I have reasons, but I don't want to be lied to. No, no. Everybody believes in purity. And you could go down a list of things, and I've said this before many times, but I'm trying to help us help others. People actually really do believe in purity. They just don't understand what they're talking about. And they don't believe it can happen. But it can, because it starts with God in us. Take your sandals off. This is holy ground. Take off what you're holding on to and come before God. Because without purity, well, Proverbs 6:26 says, for by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread. You know, oh, I was just loafing around. I didn't, but that's pretty bad. Just seeing if you're listening. But here's the thing is that, but if you'll get back to where I was and forgive me, do you know there was a wholeness and now you're reduced. And that's what it does. Instead of reducing like on a stove where you boil down that tomato sauce or whatever, now you've overflowed it and you've ruined the stove and you've ruined the pot and you've ruined the stuff in it and it's spread everywhere. Proverbs 5:15 and 16 says, drink water out of your own cistern. It's talking about a sexual relationship of a man and a woman in a marriage, and talks about how that's an important thing. It says, drink water out of your own cistern and running water out of your own well, should your fountain be dispersed abroad and streams of water out in the streets. In other words, what is intended to bring forth fruitfulness and produce, you know, water out of your cistern, feed you, you drink it, you wash with it, it purifies your life, and you also water your crops. And instead, it's just going all over the street, and those streets were dirt, and it just drained out, and you got nothing from it. In fact, you lose. God does not want people to lose. God is not an ogre. God is not stiff and harsh and mean. He knows what makes the human work. And we have proven, and we've had generations in our nation, we've had generations to prove that it doesn't work what we're doing. Just because people fail to do it God's way perfectly and there's oppression of women by men, okay, that's totally wrong. Just because there was hidden things and bad things doesn't mean everything that ever was done. It's not about former America. It's about God's word. America was never the perfect place. God is perfect and tells you right now today, I want you to have intimacy with me. This is whether you're single or married or ever will be, or ever will be again, because it goes way beyond the sexual relationship. It has to do with what is true intimacy and oneness, and it comes from God. It is Him. It's His character. It's His nature. He's the one that invented you. He didn't just create you. He invented you. I'm just a word to help you kind of think about, I was invented. God made me up, and He knows what makes me work. So instead of producing blessing as watering crops, it vanishes in the dust. This speaks to the unmarried or physically unable to carry out that part of our marriage relationships. Things happen. But you know what? You can still have intimacy because it's a greater passion regardless of the sex. That's a beautiful thing. And I've always used this example. If you value something, if it's valuable, then you treat it with value. And my best example is the candy bar. You buy a candy bar for $1.25, you unwrap it, you take a bite, you don't like it, too sweet, too many nuts, you throw it away or give it to somebody else. It's only a candy bar. It only costs you $1.25. You could throw it in the garbage, it doesn't matter. But if you do that with relationship, if you do that with what God has intended, you're throwing yourself away. You're throwing yourself away. And God is pleading with His people, I want you to experience something that you only will know because of what I do in your life. And you can be redeemed. His people were 400 years in bondage. Maybe you've had 40 years. Maybe there is somebody today here. For 40 years, your life has had nothing to do with any of this. It's been all the opposite. God wants to redeem you. He wants to redeem your life. You have friends. You have people. Don't say they'll never change. Don't say it'll never work out for them. Say, God, have mercy and bring them to the knowledge of Jesus and let them see how much you love them, because the passion you have for them has not waned just because I've gotten tired of them. The passion you have for them has not disappeared just because I don't feel anything. Moses was completely, seemingly passionless, but God put it back in him. So, Gail's going to come back up. Why don't you get back up here and set up, if you would, honey. And you don't mind, I called her honey. Because she is. Listen. We not only have the decorations still up because, hey, why not? Jesus says, be my Valentine. And I didn't plan a Valentine message. This is just where we are. And we have communion again this week because as often as you take it in remembrance of me. And I want to remind you that God was in Christ reconciling himself to the world. God has a passion for you that will not waver. And with fervent desire, that means fervent desire, a hot stove, man, bubbling at the top, not going over the edge, but just totally filling the house. And the Bible even talks about in the New Testament, the savor of Christ that exudes from us is like it's a sweet-smelling savor, using the senses to express God's passion and love. I'm not off track here. This is the story of the Passover. This is the story of communion. This is the story of the new covenant. This is the story of Jesus Christ. And this is your story as well.